This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:08 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we are counting down to the biggest story of the day.
Number 5.
A pay hike of over 13% for civil servants is on the cards.
Right. So this was announced by the Prime Minister, Dr. Sri Anwar Ibrahim, while launching the National Labour Day celebrations yesterday. And we spoke about this, Lynn, just last week. At the time, the details were quite scarce.
Yeah. So we now have more details for you. It's an update of sorts. Under the revamped Public Service Remuneration System, or SPPA, civil servants will take home a minimum overall monthly income of 2,000 ringgit. That's up from the current rate of 1,765, and that's going to include things like allowances and so on. Salary increments overall is going to be more than 13%, and this is all expected to begin in December this year.
So as you said, Lynn, these are additional details, though Anwar has also said that more information on the SPPA will be unveiled later this year. In the meantime, though, government is going through is going to be allocating more than 10 billion ringgit to make this happen.
So at the moment, it does feel as if every week is another update. It's understandable that this happened in conjunction with Labour Day, but it does feel like it's kind of a slow burning conversation because we are still waiting for, I think, the other proposals that are going to be contained within the revamp. That's one. The other thing is, while this is kicking in December this year, what I understand was that that's kind of almost a bonus of sorts, because the PM did say that this is supposed to begin in January next year, but we're kind of pushing it back earlier. So, yeah, I mean, I understand why this would be much needed for the civil service. I think, though, that a lot of the questions that were raised in our conversation from last week are going to persist, right? Questions about, 10 billion ringgit, how are we going to manage that? Questions about ensuring that performance keeps up as well with the pay hike, just all these different things.
Yeah, so I guess this is happening in the context of a cost of living crunch that a lot of people are suffering from.
Which, by the way, the Prime Minister said in an interview, I think, with Bernama TV, that he doesn't contest it so much as says that it's something that people, that if you look at the numbers, that it's not, I suppose, as bad as people are experiencing it to be.
Yeah, and I mean, and that actually might be true because our inflation rates are actually quite low and so on and so forth. But people don't feel things like that quite in the same way as an economist might, looking at the aggregate numbers and, you know, and sort of drawing conclusions from that. But certainly the, you know, all politicians and all governments or all political parties in government have to keep the civil service on side. So it's, you know, no harm in giving out sweetness, but they also have signaled that underperformance will not be rewarded. So there's a kind of carrot and stick thing happening here, I think, in the conversations that, as you say, are kind of like are being doled out on a kind of weekly basis.
I'm hoping that with now that we have the carrot, right, now that the carrot has become very clear, a minimum salary of 2,000, a pay hike of more than 13%, which is what it has been in the past, that the next thing that we hear is going to be more details about that measurement of performance, simply because the primary audience has been spoken to, the civil service, right? Like they needed to know what this was going to look like, what the timeline was going to be, how much they're going to make. So that's been communicated. And now for people outside of the civil service, for Malaysians as a whole, I think the next level of curiosity will be these conversations that we're having, for which we don't have the answers yet. Let us know if you have thoughts. That number to call is 7733 2900. Send us a voice note or WhatsApp 018 789 8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number 4.
Continuing the countdown to the biggest story of the day on Top 5 at 5, this is quite a sweet one. So efforts to preserve Kelantan's wayang kulit.
So Kelantan's Wayang Kulit has been submitted to UNESCO for its list of intangible cultural heritage. The Heritage Department of Malaysia said that the bid for UNESCO recognition was to safeguard the future of Wayang Kulit Kelantan, which is facing imminent extinction.
Yeah, because after all, it is actually currently the sole surviving form of shadow puppet theatre in our country. Three others are well extinct, Wayang Kulit Gedek, Wayang Kulit Melayu, and Wayang Kulit Purwo. So I think this is... I love talking about heritage in general, but I think that there is something special when we talk about intangible cultural heritage, because there's something about the phrasing of that, there's something about the recognition of it that speaks to, I suppose, the invisible threads that connect our society, that keep us afloat, that maybe it's harder to recognize, right? That's where that intangibility comes in.
I've actually been very lucky in watching a performance in Kelantan, you know, in a Chinese kampung, believe it or not. Dola Baju Merah was the dalang, and that whole performance was being filmed by a documentary maker. I think it became a series, and the director was Bernice Choli. I was quite surprised because it was World Cup season, and yet there were so many young people who were there watching this, and they were really, I think, really involved. It did seem in many ways a kind of a living culture.
So we'll get to that shortly, but we did reach out to Edin Koo, who is the founder and director of Pusaka, to firstly unpack what makes Wayang Kulit Kelantan unique.
Our Wayang Kulit tradition is actually very unique and remains very unique. Whereas in a lot of other countries, there have been efforts to classicize or institutionalize the traditional arts. Of course, there are efforts to do that here also. But I think in Kelantan in particular, in Malaysia, we do still retain a very authentic, a very vibrant folk-associated version of Wayang Kulit, yeah? So while we do have institutions like universities and the National Arts Academy, the tradition of Wayang Kulit that is practiced by the people, for the people in their own regions and districts, remain very vibrant. In terms of repertoire, in terms of style, also we are very unique, combining a whole array of influences that makes the Wayang Kulit Siam, Wayang Kulit Kelantan, you know, very, very unique and still practiced pretty much as the way it has been done for generations. I think this authenticity, this faithfulness to the cultural lineage of these traditions is what makes Wayang Kulit Siam of Kelantan especially unique.
Edin also spoke about the efforts to bring young people into the field and the importance of cultural sustainability.
While the nomination is very good, there's already ongoing work that has been very successful in terms of passing down the Wayang Kulit tradition. Our organization, Pusaka, has been very involved in that for close to 30 years. I think the most important thing, apart from the nomination, is that if it is successful, then real effort must be made at the ground level, at the grassroots level, to ensure that young people are brought in to the tradition, which is already kind of opening up. I'd like to stress that in, you know, Pusaka's work, about 85% of our people involved are under the age of 30. So there's a lot of interest among the young. It's just these opportunities need to be created and, very importantly, sustained. Now, when we talk about the age of sustainability, somehow we in Malaysia only talk about environmental sustainability, but there's another very important dimension, which is cultural sustainability. And we have to understand that culture is really a reflection of the lived history of this country. So when you look at the Wayang Kulit, you look at the broad influences that have shaped and created a Wayang Kulit tradition in our country, which is quite separate from the Wayang traditions of other countries and other regions. So I think this nomination should also come with a real effort at expanding the breadth of knowledge, not just about Wayang Kulit as a performance form, but really what it encapsulates in terms of our cultural history, our cultural interactions, and very importantly, about the life of, you know, the people of the regions in this country.
That was Edin Koo, founder and director of Pusaka, speaking about Wayang Kulit. And we'd like to hear from you because Wayang Kulit, Kelantan's Wayang Kulit has been submitted to UNESCO for recognition as an intangible cultural heritage. If you'd like to weigh in, that number to call is 7733 2900. Send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we're continuing the countdown on Top 5 at 5 to the biggest story of the day. So stay tuned for that. BFM 89.9.
Boleh for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is 5:19 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. So far, story 5, salary hikes for civil servants. Story 4, Wayang Kulit being recognised, hopefully, as an intangible cultural heritage.
Number 3.
Which brings us to a hard pivot, a proposal for public caning for Sharia offences in Terengganu.
So this is really just something that's being thought of and discussed, but it did come up because Dr. Muhammad Khalil Abdul Hadi, the State Information Da'wa and Sharia Empowerment Committee Chairman from Terengganu, said that the state is considering to strengthen the implementation of Sharia law there.
So I think it might be best to quote him directly on this, right? And the crucial thing here is the mooting of public caning. So he said, actually, if you look at the spirit of punishment for those who commit offences under Sharia law, it must be carried out in public, but it can be subjective. By public, does it mean in the middle of a public place like a market, or is it a mosque, or can it just be anything? If caning is carried out in prison, it can be said to have been done in public as it is witnessed by certain people. So based on this, we'll carry on what we're doing now.
Now, for the time being, then, it's status quo. However, members of the federal government have weighed in on this issue. Religious Affairs Minister Dato' Muhammad Naim Mokhtar has said that the implementation of public caning for Sharia offences would fall under state governments, though he noted that a comprehensive study should be carried out, including the definition of public, the philosophy of punishment, and whether there's a balancing of education and as well as preserving dignity.
So that's one minister. Another relevant minister is Law Minister Datuk Sri Azalina Uthman Syed, who pointed to complexities in implementing this proposal because managing Sharia criminal offences would require assistance from federal agencies. So even though it's under state jurisdiction, nonetheless, it involves the police and the prisons department, and they fall under federal purview. And so amendments to existing laws would be needed. She also said, and this is very important, no discussions between the federal and Terengganu state governments have taken place over this issue.
Right, so we reached out to Sharia lawyer Nizam Bashir for rationale of this proposal and how it ties to Islamic laws.
The rationale of public caning in Terengganu is likely based on Surah An-Nur verse 2. And that basically says, let a group of believers witness their punishment. And I suppose one part of the underlying philosophy to that verse is to inculcate Islamic values and manifest its value in public life. As far as how does Islamic law interpret public caning as a form of punishment? Well, from the perspective of hukum syara, aside from what the Quranic verse provides, public caning also has its jurisprudence in hukum syara, in the views espoused by various religious scholars such as Ibn Abbas, Az-Zuhri and Hasan al-Bashri.
He also spoke about other factors we need to consider when discussing this notion of public caning.
Of course, when we look at the issue of public caning, we must also consider Article 5 of the Federal Constitution. Article 5 guarantees the right to life and personal liberty. This includes the right to live with human dignity. And you can see this also in the decision of the Federal Court in Tan Teck Seng. Of course, caning, leave alone being inflicted in public, it is considered to be a cruel and degrading form of punishment. Consequently, it is an affront to human dignity to subject an individual to caning. And that issue arguably becomes more acute when the person that's been caned is either a woman or even minors. So I suppose there's a range of issues involved when we are deliberating and talking about the issue of public caning. And that range of issues may even, I suppose, cause a dilemma on, you know, when we are looking at this issue. And we have to resolve that dilemma as Malaysian Muslims. It may require some reconciliation between our spiritual aspirations, much like the ones referred to in Karim Salama's song of wanting to live in a land called paradise, and what the federal constitution itself guarantees all Malaysians.
So that was Sharia lawyer Nizam Bashir. Again, if you have thoughts on the story, you know the drill. That number to call is 7733 2900. Send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number 2.
And now, continuing this countdown, the Perlis Menteri Besar is being investigated over alleged abuse of power.
So the MACC confirmed the arrest of Apasa's Mohammad Shakir Ramli, who's the Menteri Besar of Perlis, after he turned up at the headquarters to give his statement this morning. He was released afterwards on bail. The investigation involves infrastructure development projects, including repairs, maintenance, supplies and services throughout the state.
So back in April, you may remember that the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission confirmed that a senior leader in the northern region was being investigated on suspicion of appointing several companies that purportedly all had ties to him, all for supply projects that were estimated to sit at the 300,000 mark.
So MACC sources also said that the leader is suspected to have appointed several companies for road repairs and maintenance works, and the companies in question are believed to have ties to his son, who I believe was taken in before the father. The projects involve allocations of about 1 million ringgit from the Menteri Besar's office. Shukri is being investigated under Section 23 of the MACC Act 2009.
So we reached out to Dr. Azmi Hassan, Senior Fellow at the Nusantara Academy of Strategy Research, to ask him firstly about the optics of this, especially with the ongoing narratives floating around of selective investigation and political persecution.
It is true that the government is always on the defensive side when any opposition politician being charged for abuse of power or corruption. But I think this political persecution accusation by an opposition is something that is normal. But again, if MACC doesn't have anything concrete, they won't remand, for example, the Menteri Besar son for a number of days and question the Menteri Besar for, I think, 7 to 8 hours. There must be something to it. So to say that this is a political persecution, yes, they can say that because the opposition politicians are involved in this, not the government politician. But again, when I say whether it's a political persecution or that there is a political motive to it, anyone who are on the wrong side, in this case, the opposition is on the wrong side, whether they want to call it political persecution or not, I think they have to answer for it.
We also asked Azmi about the political ramifications of this, especially for PAS.
Yes, the significance of a Menteri Besar Perlis has been questioned, not yet being charged. But I think being Perlis, this is the first time that PAS administrated the state or conquered the state. I think the political ramification, not only in Perlis for PAS, but also nationally. Because PAS, they have the leverage that their leadership is clean from any corruption. So for a Menteri Besar being questioned, and maybe after this we don't know whether they'll be charged, so the political ramification for PAS nationally is so huge. They cannot use anymore that they are pious, that they are clean from corruption, when a Menteri Besar, a statue of Menteri Besar being questioned and charged maybe later. So this will give a black dot on PAS that we view before this. Yes, they are not that efficient, but they are clean, free from corruption, their leadership. So this will give a huge impact on PAS.
That was Dr. Azmi Hassan, Senior Fellow at the Nusantara Academy of Strategic Research, talking about the conversations and perceptions around the Perlis Menteri Besar, Mohammad Shukri Ramli, being investigated by MACC over alleged abuse of power. Again, if you would like to weigh in on any of the stories that we've covered so far, that number to call is 7733 2900. Send a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:38 and you are listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. So a quick recap in case you missed it. So far, what we've covered: a significant salary hike for civil servants, Wayang Kulit as intangible cultural heritage, a proposal for public caning in Terengganu, and the Perlis MB being investigated by MACC. So we've been asking you for your thoughts, and that number to call, 7733 2900. You can send us a voice note or WhatsApp, 018-789-8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. So we do have a voice note that's come in on the subject of wayang kulit. Here is Roberto.
I really love wayang kulit. I do not understand why there are not more exhibitions of that beautiful art here in KL. I witnessed it once and I fall in love, and I try to always to find ways to watch it again. I'm really happy that somebody is putting this beautiful art into the protection of United Nations. I hope you guys get it. It's a really, really unique cultural heritage that should be preserved, and not just preserved, but promoted. It's something unique that it can be easily promoted around the world. Hopefully you guys get it.
Thank you so much, Roberto. I mean, I certainly hope so as well. I think it would have meaning, one, but also I'm hoping that it would create a larger sense of interest, you know, rather than just pockets of kind of vague exposure to it, which is how I think a lot of us experience, unfortunately, a lot of our cultural arts.
Yeah, Roberto, I don't know if you would have been around, but when I was very young, you know, we had wayang kulit on TV, and and that was quite. I mean, I would watch it because there was, you know, frankly, there wasn't very much going on television. There were only like two channels, well, actually four, if you lived in JB as I did. But the point was, you know, there's a lot to learn about the stories, right? And so, a part of the appreciation is to understand the Ramayana. And also the way in which, you know, the language that is spoken and all that. But there's nothing, and I say that just to make everybody else who's never done this feel really jealous, is I actually been to Kelantan and watched a live performance, several days of it. As I said before, you know, it was part of Bernice Cholley's documentary series, Semangat Insan, Masters of Tradition. It was just wonderful to be with real people, to see this operate, be able to go in front and behind the stage. And because, as you know, those wonderful puppets are kind of black and white, the shadows, right? But the actual material puppets are actually beautifully decorated.
Yes, yes, they are very ornate. And anyway, let us know if you have thoughts on the various stories that we've covered today, or particularly about wayang kulit. You can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be back after this with our top stories. So keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Boleh for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5:43. You are listening to Top 5 at 5 with Lynn and Sharad, where we count down to the biggest story of the day, which is where we have arrived.
Number 1.
A call for better workers' rights in conjunction with Labour Day. So yesterday, more than 1,000 workers from various sectors marched to Dataran Merdeka, demanding for exactly this.
Yeah, and it was interesting because there were many groups. You know, one of the core groups, of course, was the Parti Socialist Malaysia, but there were 60 other groups there, including those representing social concerns, like Orang Asli concerns or women and such. I don't know if media people were there, but you'd think that, you know, in fact, journalists ought to have been there because they are, in some ways, workers themselves.
So 8 demands were kind of put forth. Firstly, a RM2,000 cost of living salary rather than the minimum wage, and an abolition of the contract system for workers. Healthcare rights for all government hospital staff, that's number 2. 3, stop forced evictions without providing alternatives. 4, equal rights and to give equal rights and to stop the exploitation of migrant workers. 5, to control grocery prices. 6, to repeal laws that violate basic rights such as gender discrimination. 7, to stop privatizing basic amenities, water, electricity, public transport, education. And 8, to recognize Orang Asli's ancestral land. So I think, as you pointed out there, Sharadan, a kind of intersectional approach to thinking about workers' rights and how it goes with social issues of various groups. So we are going to be getting into it, and joining us now to do that, we have Dr. Michael Jayakumar Devaraj, who is the chairperson of PSM. Dr. Jayakumar, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, as we said yesterday, more than 1,000 people marched to Dataran Merdeka, including women's rights groups, Orang Asli, Palestinian rights groups such as Gega America. What does this diversity reflect?
I think it reflects the point that many groups don't feel they're getting a fair share from the economy, that many groups are having various kinds of problems, from the farmers to the Orang Asli to the gig workers, the contract workers in government institutions, ordinary factory workers. I mean, everyone feels that they're struggling. The cost of living is high, what they're making is not enough. And that's why they're coming together to put forward their requests, their demands on Labor Day.
No, Dr. Kumar, every time Labor Day comes around, you look at the headlines internationally in many cities, whether in Europe or across the world, in Latin America, thousands upon thousands of people march. 1,000 people in Malaysia is not bad a number, but I'm just wondering about what it reflects, because it's not a huge number either. Unionization levels are so low, and they do, and said over and over again, reflect a weak bargaining position of workers in general. I mean, what is going on? Why aren't workers unionizing at the levels they should in order to be stronger in the bargaining process?
I think our government has been anti-union for a long time, you know. We had very strong unions in the 1940s and 1950s, but they were deemed too radical, too progressive, and they were culled. I mean, and then we had a kind of a moderate trade union leadership inculcated. And even those had the tightening of labor laws from time to time, you know, in the 60s, a couple of times the labor laws were tightened. So I think it's because of government policy. I mean, like in some countries like Vietnam, for example, it is by law that you must have a union. That everyone is unionized, you know what I mean. So I think it's largely government policy that has led to this.
So if we look at what the Prime Minister has kind of addressed in his May Day speech, he announced a record raise in civil service pay, which we spoke about earlier on the show. Do you consider this a welcome move?
Yeah, I think it's a good move for, especially for the civil servants earning less than, say, $8,000, $10,000. But I wonder whether they're going to have a civil pay, you know, a servant's pay rise for those who are in the top excellence, you know, who are earning more than 10,000. I'm wondering whether that's required. But definitely for the lower levels of civil service, yes, it's required.
Now, let's look at some of the demands that were articulated, you know, at yesterday's event. One of them is raising the minimum wage to 2,000 ringgit. Now, considering the difficulty of getting the current level and getting buy-in on the current level, which I believe is about 1,500, correct me if I'm wrong, how do you propose to get to 2,000 ringgit?
I think, you know, the reason why we are putting this forward is the cost of living is so high. I mean, like Bank Negara has done a study, right? Saying, I think this 2018, when they said a single person living in KL would need about 4,300 or something like that to survive. So we think of a single, a family with a single, let's say a single mother working in KL. How would she survive with 1,005? Even 2,000 isn't quite enough. So the question I'll put to you, Sharad, is the other way around. How come in a nation where the GDP has, you know, increased by about 24-fold over the last 50 years, in real terms, after taking care of inflation, how come a nation with that much of wealth, we still can't give a living wage? So when you put forward a demand like this, and then if the government or employers say they cannot, then we can ask them, then they could have a dialogue. Why are we in an economic model that grows the GDP so well, but is unable to pay a decent minimum wage to the workers who create the wealth? And that's where we want to take this to, you know.
Another thing that I was hoping to talk about was that considering the low employment rate, talk to us about the reasoning behind putting guaranteed employment on the list of demands. Is the hope here for the low unemployment rate, pardon me. Do you mean for those not absorbed by the private sector to be made government workers?
No, we're not really talking about that. I think if you look at the unemployment rates, I think there is a problem in the way in which they are calculated. You know, I mean, right now, our working age population from 18 to 60 would be about 22 million people. But only 16 million people in the job market, reasonably people who are working now. So the way we calculate is a person must indicate that he's looking for work, he or she is looking for work, and he's not able to get more than one day of work in the previous 1 week. And that's when they consider part of the unemployed. It means you have less than one day of work a week and you are looking for work. So there is a problem there. You know, if you look at things like in Sungai Siput, a lot of the Malay men, the age in the 30s and 40s, are underemployed. They can't find proper jobs. You know, factories won't take them. They go to work in the farms. They find that the illegal migrants are there. Migrants run away from their workers, from their workplaces without passports, and they're working for low wages. So there is a lot of underemployment and unemployment. And even for graduates, I think almost 2/3 of our graduates are working on jobs which don't require their qualification. And so they don't get the proper wages. So I think there is a big mismatch between the need for work and the work they're getting. And I think the way in which the underemployment figure is defined has a problem. It doesn't measure the problem properly.
You know, it just seemed like the Prime Minister's reach out to the public sector was a good thing, as you mentioned. But I wonder about something about the nature of public sector work as well, because over the years, we've noticed how many jobs in the public sector have turned into contract work. And I think PSM in particular has been working with hospital cleaners and janitorial staff where their welfare is quite dismal. Can you give us a sense of how the public sector might not even be a safe place anymore because people are there, but they're not getting the protection that public sector jobs are supposed to afford them?
Well, I think, you know, for the contract workers, you know, the cleaners, the security guards in schools, in hospitals, they've had a bad deal, you know, because once they become contract, then every 3 years their job is renewed. And every 3 years they go back to the basic minimum wage. There's no pension, there's no IGN, route to IGN, you know, there's no housing loan. So actually, even if that saves money for the government, I think it's a very bad way of saving money. You're making the B20 in the country even more insecure, even more precarious in your wish to save money. So I don't think it works well. And it all comes from this whole neoliberal kind of thinking that the market is the best thing. You got to outsource production wherever you can, you know. It comes from all these kind of dangerous ideas from IMF and the World Bank, which actually makes workers more vulnerable and less security, yes.
Another demand here was for a universal basic income of 1,000 ringgit for people in the informal sector. How many folks would fall within this category and what might the total cost of this initiative be for the government?
Okay, if you look at it that way, let's see. The borderline between B40 and M40 is about a monthly income for a family of 4,300. That's the borderline for B40, M40. And the B20 would be those, the bottom 20% are those, the family income of about 2,009. So you're talking about $1,000 a month for a family. I think it's just about 1% or, you know, 1% of the whole families in the country. Talking about maybe 80,000 families. So what we're saying is if a family is not making $1,000 a month, you've got to top it up to at least 1,000. I mean, that's hardly enough, right? Yeah, that's what we're saying.
Right. So, talking about families is quite interesting because the lockdowns that instituted during the COVID pandemic had, as we all understand, a devastating impact on workers in the informal economy and exacerbated learning gaps for working class children. Dr. Kumar, do you see enough being done for working class families?
No, I don't. I don't. Because the government has got this paralysis saying that our debt is so high, we can't spend anymore. So a lot of things that need to be done. For example, our urban areas, we have so many low-cost flats which are looking like slums, you know. The government should put some money into that and spruce them up a bit, repair the lifts, and maybe start tuition spaces where people can give tuition, you know. You've got to put some facilities into those kinds of things. We're not doing those kinds of things because we say, oh, our debt is so high, we can't do this and can't do that. So I don't think enough is being done, yes.
There are also approximately 3 million Malaysians who do gig work. Around 98% of delivery riders are 30 and below. And your demands do include an act for gig workers. Talk to us about what that would entail.
Well, I think they would have to be considered as employees of these companies. They should be eligible for some kind of medical leave, sick leave. They should all be covered by some kind of social protection like SOCSO and EPF. You've got to make sure they get that. And they got to be covered from super exploitation, you know. They just met the gig workers yesterday. And they're talking about how their commissions have been cut down and how the companies, there's a real imbalance between companies and the gig workers, you know, because the companies are big, they're well organized, and the gig workers are also atomized, you know. So whether the government's got to help them or they got to be encouraged to form associations and unions to discuss back. But they are, and many of them work for 12 hours a day, you know, to make ends meet. So actually, it is not a very healthy kind of a lifestyle for them.
We have a question from a listener, Eunice, who says, why can't contract employees negotiate contract terms or a pay rise for their services upon renewal of the contract?
Well, because there are so many people looking for jobs. There's a lot of unemployment. So, you know, you don't take the job on the terms the contractor is offering you, you won't get the job. So that's a problem. There's underemployment. A lot of these contract workers are older people and they are so scared of losing their job.
Yeah, so finally, you know, are you optimistic for the future of workers' rights in our country?
Well, that all depends on whether we, PSM, and the NGOs and people who are concerned can get together and work towards it. Because we need to look for a new paradigm. We've got to basically ask the country, ask ourselves, ask our planners, how come in a country where the GDP has gone up 24-fold over the last 50 years, why are we not able to provide employment for all our youth? Why aren't we able to increase our healthcare services? And why are our wages so low that, you know, the rate of malnutrition is 17%, you know, among, if you look at stunting among children below the age of five, I think it's something like 17%, which is ridiculous in a country that has got so much wealth. So I think the whole question of the paradigm of development is the wealth. So is this growing the GDP and getting FDI? Is that enough? And shouldn't we be more about spreading that about? So these are the issues that I think we need to discuss and see what's the way forward of improving the lot of the B40, the B20, without upsetting the apple cart. We want to still want to have growth. We want to have development, right? We want to grow the GDP, yes, but not at the expense of the people at the bottom of the pie, you know? So that's the kind of debate we need to go through.
Dr. Jayakumar, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for inviting me.
That was Dr. Michael Jayakumar Devaraj, chairperson of Parti Socialist Malaysia, talking to us about the calls that have been put forth for better workers' rights. Among other things, there are several demands. I would suggest looking at them. This is in conjunction with Labour Day. You've been listening to Top 5 at 5, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.